Just a reminder before we start, please silence all cell phones. Thank you.
Good morning again. For those who are visiting us for the first time, we ask you to pick up our little yellow pamphlet. It's called the Declaration of the ULT, because on the back, it gives you all the information you need. Who are these people? What goes on in these rooms? And on the front, it tells you it is for the purpose of spreading broadcast the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, who lived more than 100 years ago, and in 1875 in Flatbush, New York and Brooklyn, they and a group of interested parties formed the Theosophical Society in the United States. In 1909, that name became the United Lodge of Theosophy, for Theosophists. On the back, you will find the Declaration, which we will read to you shortly. But first, let us give you a rundown on what takes place here on a weekly, a bi-weekly basis. As you know, today we're here on Sunday morning, and the doors opened at 10:30, and we began promptly at 11 p.m., and we'll be through at noon. We divide the period, a three-month period, into the Sunday morning talks. And today is November the 18th, and the topic this morning is reincarnation, application of the doctrine. And we meet on Wednesdays also. Doors open at 5:30, and meeting begins at 7:30. And those 2 hours give you an opportunity to visit our library, ask questions, because it's a lovely old building, and everybody takes notice of that. But in the library, you will find a group of books, mostly for reference, not takeout. And you'll find a volunteer there who will explain to you what takes place that evening, give you references and a little pamphlet or booklet so that you may become familiar with the topic that evening. In the middle, as you passed through, coming in here, you saw a desk, and behind the desk, books. As you came down the aisle, on your left-hand side, you saw several cabinets. In those cabinets, you will find pamphlets. All of these books and pamphlets don't cost very much at all. And if you wish, you can ask the volunteer at the desk the price of any document or book that you want to take home with you. But nevertheless, we have this little pamphlet which you can take home, and on the table near the usher, you'll find other broadsides, we call them, in which you will find items that you can read in private to get a better idea of the purpose. Now, as you can see, we're all volunteers who dedicate our time to pass out these ideas, finding ourselves in accord with what we have heard over time. And therefore, you can see the whole lodge, all its activities depend on voluntary contributions, first in time and work, and also on voluntary contributions of money as you choose. Now, everyone in the audience who do is invited to participate, but no obligation is imposed or implied. On the pamphlet, you will find several things. You'll find our address, phone number, and also you can go online. Our duty, since we find most of all the volunteers being in accord with what they heard. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It's loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. At the book table, you may find a card which someone will show you, and it's generally signed by the associates of the United Lodge of Theosophists. And the wording is very clear. Being in sympathy with the purposes of this lodge, as set forth in its declaration, I hereby record my desire to be enrolled as an associate. It being understood that such association calls for no obligation on my part other than that which I myself determine. Very clear. Also, on the back of the declaration, you'll see a list of other lodges situated all over the globe. Now, as is the custom, before the meeting begins and we hear the lecture, a reading has been chosen by the chair. And this reading, or readings, will be found in the Bhagavad Gita, one of our most favorite texts, which we discuss generally all summer long, chapter by chapter. The reading begins, it's in several sections on several pages. Those who are wise in spiritual things grieve neither for the dead nor for the living. I myself never was not, nor thou, nor all the princes of the earth, nor shall we ever hereafter cease to be. As the Lord of this mortal frame experiences therein infancy, youth, and old age, so in future incarnations will it meet the same. One who is confirmed in this belief is not disturbed by anything that may come to pass. Now the reading will continue on the next page. As a man throweth away old garments and putteth on new, even even so the dweller in the body, having quitted its old mortal frames, entereth into others which are new. The weapon divideth not, the fire burneth it not, the water corrupteth it not, the wind drieth not away, for it is indivisible and inconsumable and incorruptible, and is not to be dried away. It is eternal, universal, permanent, immovable. It is invisible, inconceivable, and unalterable. Therefore, knowing it to be thus, thou shouldest grieve. But whether thou believest it to be of eternal birth and duration, or that it dieth with the body, still thou hast no cause to lament it. Therefore, knowing it to be thus, thou should not grieve. Now we'll have our talk.
Thank you. For those of you who have been coming this whole month and last month, but especially this month, I'm wondering if anyone else has noticed that we started off with one life, one self, one source. We then last week had the sister doctrine of karma to reincarnation. And then we will be ending next week with the basis of human evolution. Basically, you're hearing the three fundamental propositions of the philosophy of theosophy that the whole is based on. And we thought it was very interesting for those who have been here for them. By the time we finish with this month, we have also had a good bit of information about those fundamental principles, the propositions that underlie this whole theosophy. But before we start off with the application, we thought we would do briefly what is or what are the doctrines that deal with reincarnation. We want to mention also that at the book table, there's a little pamphlet called Reincarnation and Karma. The first section is on reincarnation. It is very interesting. And, of course, the back part is on karma. Very briefly, it's a little booklet to give us a lot of information. But if we look at the idea that we are all souls, and we've all lived before in other bodies and other civilizations, and that we will live again and again in future circumstances, and we will be using and fashioning in this present life and other past lives the details that will make up that lifetime. If we have this idea of a universal application that prevails in regions far beyond the grasp of the present science or of the average man's mind, it can be proven, checked in every step. So periodically, there is a re-embodiment of consciousness. Our form, our physical body, is expressing that inquired and acquired intelligence of the time that we have gained. The philosophy tells us, as thinking human beings, we have been evolving over 18 million years. If we look at the time between births, which is approximately, for most, it's 1,500 years, we figure out that if that be it, and at this time as we sit here today, we've been through practically everything we could possibly think of to experience. And yet, here we are. That main idea of reincarnating is that possibility that in lifetime's progress, plus at some time in one's life where we make a decision that we really want to know what life is all about in that detail, that it is possible that in this whole vast period of evolution that there is certain perfectibilities at certain stages that one can gain a knowledge far beyond through all the past lessons and situations and experiences one has been through. Now, we have to remember that even though we have this true consciousness, the connection that we have to use and express as spiritual souls reincarnating is a form, some sort of form. For us, it is this physical body. And if we can remember within this physical body, everything is new this lifetime. So we could understand maybe when we ask that question, well, why don't I remember who or what I was or when I was? This physical brain does not have that knowledge within it. And we as thinkers do have a part of our nature that holds this knowledge we have gained in a part of our nature that is of a higher nature that we possibly don't touch much during a lifetime unless we put an effort out. As was stated earlier, theosophy is universal, but theosophy is a philosophy and a teachings of life that has to be tested, checked. We have to use the idea that we apply some of these ideas and test them for ourselves and check them for ourselves. So if we look at the idea, basically starting off with that, in each one of us, there is a changeless perceiver. All the changes that go through our body and our minds, life after life, there is a perceiver of that. And that is the immortal perceiver or thinker within that we were talking about. This is that changeless principle that's within us. And the information is carried within a higher principle called the Bodhi principle. The philosophy lets us know that we are more complex than we see, that we are a sevenfold individual, and we express through this physical lower material frame in each life, that which will come to us. Now, the conditions that the real thinker sees and understands, it tells us, are created by previous thoughts and acts of the thinker in this life or in many previous lives. But let us remember that the thinker is not any of these experiences. That is the perceiver that observes. And in our life, with our ordinary consciousness, does not really carry that stamp, shall we say, of the soul. Our minds have, as it states, all sorts of stamps put upon us by our senses, by our desires, some good, some bad. The important thing is these come to us by natural impulse. And we, instead of, shall we say, of examining them, evaluating them, or accepting some and rejecting others, by virtue of our, shall we say, our being, we allow our minds to receive them all. And this goes on a daily basis. And we start to wonder, too, then, if that be the case, what about that barrage of all the unlearned lessons in life? Why is it one has to go over something over and over and over until it finally clicks, till we finally see what has to be done? For most, as was said, it's coming from an outside nature. We're just receiving these things in, and we're not taking the time to really think as thinkers. So then, what can we really rely on? Where can I look for the proof of this re-embodiment that this philosophy and many philosophies far beyond historical times have known these ideas and have kept them alive down through civilizations? So now if we come to that point, let's look for something that hasn't changed, something that we know, and we talk about it every day, but we never really realize what we're actually saying. What about our identity? What about the I that we knew as a young child, as a young person growing up, as an older adult, as an adult today? I that we say I, mostly thinking it's this personality that we live in at this time. It's far deeper than that, because we know there's a lot of changes within this personality. Our likes, our dislikes, our wants, our needs, our ideas that we hold, which for most, they're not really our ideas. These are ideas of something we've read, something we've been told, or ideas that have come from the outside and we just sort of sucked them up like a sponge. And we call them, these are my ideas. But are they really? Have most of the lessons that we've gone through that are still unlearned been investigated, been tested, been checked, or do we just accept it? This main idea that we can look at as there's no beginning and there's no ending. It always is. And no one gave it to us, and we did not reason it out. But the most we can say is that our identity is that. It is. And on a grander scale, could we connect it with sort of like space? It just is. There is no beginning or ending that we can say of it. So this whole idea of application is, if it be that this is the teachings and we want to start to test it and check it on our own, we have to come up with some basics to work from. And HPB and William Q. Judge both have brought out some three great ideas, which are universal truths, that if we start to think on these and almost get to the point of memorizing them, it's going to give us a different atmosphere to look for. One, the soul of man is immortal, and its future is the future of a thing whose growth and splendor has no limits. Two, the principle which gives life dwells in us and without us, and is undying and eternally beneficent, is not heard or seen or smelled, but is perceived by the man who desires perception. And finally, the third one, each man is his own absolute lawgiver, the dispenser of glory or gloom to himself. The decree of his life, his rewards, or his punishment. So this is the idea of the soul of man is immortal. So when we speak in reincarnation and an application of some of these ideas, we can see that it's something that has to be worked on, not something that we pick up and put down. It's something that we have to work on, if possible, to try on a daily basis to sort of look and see what in me do I have to learn that I haven't learned yet. Because if we look at life and life's lessons, it's obviously that we're here for our faults, not our perfected ability. And yet, there are those great masters and sages down through the ages that have said, you too can reach a point where you can be all-knowing. And that we must not be able to discuss reincarnation without the doctrine of hope, which is its sister doctrine of karma. It is not a swerving, this karma. It is our responsibility and our own actions and circumstances that create karma, that cause and effect. And without no change, there could be no growth or evolution of any kind. So we could sort of look at this idea of karma be the eternal fitness of things, the balancer, the harmony. And each one of us has that opportunity to work on ourselves, to better ourselves, to be the better able to help others. Because the main idea of life is to understand that we are all one. We're all from the same essence, different degrees on outer looks, but still the same within. So when we can be a help to another, whether we realize it or not, we're being a help to ourselves. So there are many other ideas that come up, and there are many ways that we are told that look for the eternal, the permanent, the everlasting part of your nature. Because what we see today and know of this personality will not walk this way again. Certain aspects maybe, but it's transitory and it will be off and on its way. We think the Buddha has given us so many wonderful ways of thinking and his teachings are very balanced, very centered. And yet, he claims, we are made up of thought and built of thought. And as we think, so we act and will act. And as we act and think, so will we suffer or rejoice, and the whole world with us. So let us look for that part of our nature, that spiritual intuition that's within us, that intuitiveness that is giving us a hint, that knows it comes from our Buddhi quality. It knows because it has learned the balance and the harmony. So we think you might have many ideas on this idea of reincarnation and the idea of applying ourselves to understanding it. Yes.
Well, it's interesting when the discussion was about the I that we are consistently throughout our life, even though the body changes. We were discussing that with a friend the other day, and it just seems like it was kind of difficult to perceive ourselves as the same I from the time we were a baby to preschooler and then high school and now entering into mature years. And it's a shock still when we look in the mirror and we think the I in me hasn't aged, but I am looking at this physical form that has, but we still feel the same, you know, emotionally. It's just a very strange concept.
A strange concept. And yet, if we look at the idea, we use this expression many times of actors who are in a play and who have a part. They put on a costume of the period and the time, and they go out and they do their part. If they're lucky, it's a long-running show. If not, they have to look elsewhere. So they find another part. They put on another costume. They do their lines. That's, in a way, what this has been. That costume, those lines, those are all little steps, pages in a book, shall we say. But the fact of the matter, it is that same I that puts on that costume who does those lines and is in that play. That actor, we are that actor. Yes?
In using the idea of the application of the doctrine, you mentioned the 1500-year cycle as the average period between incarnations. If one is interested and very sort of practical, take a look at Rome 1500 years ago. It definitely shows part of our source as a civilization. So there are many interesting parallels and things one can use to apply the doctrine. Where do these things, people, events, cultures come from that seem to be reflected in 1500-year patterns?
That's very true. I think it's Toynbee that has an excellent book in the history. And when you see all the different things, we can see, as was stated, the Romans in their just in their building ability. We could see it now in our ability. And we can see a reoccurrence of the same type of thing approximately every 1500 years. So let's look at Egypt, for instance, the highest that we can think of Egypt, of quote, the beginning of our history of it. It is stated that great kings walked the earth. great wisdom was there. It was a peaceful time at certain areas, but the great knowledge that was then walking the earth has moved on, shall we say, to other costumes or other parts. So what we see in today, for instance, is not the same class of individuals that were in it when it was at its highest age, its highest pitch, shall we say, of talent, of intelligence. So just as was stated earlier with this idea of acting, there are younger actors that might come in and take the same part, put on the costume, but he doesn't really give the lines or the part, the life it needs, because he doesn't have the knowledge that the previous actor had in it. So we can see that we need forms to work through. We always use the expression spirit and matter is really one thing but two sides of a coin. Spirit needs matter. Matter needs spirit to ignite it. Spirit needs matter for experience. We are spiritual souls. Yes.
If I apply this analogy to a single person, and the I that you spoke of, there's this I that is my personality, my desires, my likes, my dislikes, I love chocolate, I hate mushrooms, etc., whatever, versus that core, that core me, which is my spirit, my ego, and my higher self. How do I tell which of those predilections are my personality, belong to my personality, like, say, liking chocolate, for example, or, and how do I distinguish that, which is what my core being is? So that little voice within me that says, you want to read these types of books, or you want to have predilections to this science or art, is there a way to determine which is my personality and which is my higher self that has been there for thousands of years?
Yes and no. Again, it depends on what we're mostly immensified in. And for most of us, it is this personality. It's our senses. It's our desires. Well, desire can have is a two-sided sword, too, because we can have very high desires, too. But when we mentioned briefly that idea of that spiritual soul, that intuition, that spiritual intuition, there's a part in our nature as we're going through life with all the paraphernalia from the outside that we're appealing. We're going through a situation and something tells us, shall we say, a silent voice within says, that's not it. That's not the right way. This is a touch of that real identity. It knows. And there's this expression that says the soul knows what it needs. For most of us, we don't touch that often. It's been closed off life after life after being so imbued with what's on the outside that we've forgotten what and who we really are on the inside. But there are hints, and if we sometimes take that time to, for instance, review our day before we go to bed at night, just review the day and look at it and honestly say, I could have done this better, or I feel comfortable with how this worked out. We need to silence this outside and these personalities that we've built up. It hasn't been built up just this one lifetime. It has taken many lifetimes. It's just like a habit. Habits make up our character. For all the length of times that it takes us to create a habit, that habit be- comes, our character. We can look at our character, really seriously look at it, and look at it and see the pros and the cons, and know who's looking at this that's seeing these pros and the cons. Who is it that knows, that's not it? That gives us a little hint. This is maybe we're living too much on the outside and not enough on the inside. Yes.
And we did ask you, say, to reverse perhaps the identifications. The personality, that which is changeable and temporary and has likes and dislikes and is pulled by the senses, is the me, the personal selfish me. The I am is that which is not touched at all by any of that. So that which is drawn to change, to objects of sense, as the Gita says, is temporary, is changeable, is the me, the personality, which is picked up, used for a lifetime, and laid down. That which carries forth that inner knowledge that was spoken of by the chair is the eternal I am, which is the same I am in each and every one of us, aware slightly differently because of the work we've done. And the Light of Asia says, each man's life, the outcome of his former living is. So we get a clue as to what we've worked on by the tendencies and things we bring back. We prove to ourselves, well, I didn't learn piano, but boy, my fingers play as if I've taken lessons all my life. Mm. Well, there are some things that are carried forward. Now, that's something of the material plane, but perhaps we have a joy in helping children, you know, something spiritual, so a spiritual tendency. That is something from that inner spiritual man that has blossomed.
So it can be an occasional touching of, and for some more, and for others less. It all depends. Yes?
With respect to the question earlier, like how do we know if it's the the immortal individuality or the personality. There's this tendency for some people to say, oh, well, we're never universal because we're not, you know, we're too animal-like. I mean, personally, I don't buy it. I mean, there's a lot more good going on in the world than a lot of people are willing to give themselves credit for. And, you know, everything, you know, it's got a range. There are extremes. And everybody falls within, and someone sometimes goes a little further, and someone's, you know, up or down. But it's really, ask your question. Am I doing this for the I, me, my, whatever it is I'm doing, whatever this thing I'm thinking, or am I doing it for the service that it offers whoever it is that I'm trying to service? Mm-hmm. You know, a mom raising her kid can be doing it really selfishly so that she can prove to all the other moms on the block that her kid gets all A's. That's selfish. That's a selfish motive. It is. And mom across the street might be more along the lines of trying to be the mom and love every children on the block as much as she loves her own children. Wouldn't it be great to live in a neighborhood that had moms like that? A lot of moms that are not like that. So, you know, I don't know. Let's not, you know, words are powerful. And when we say, well, we're not very spiritual, and walk out the doors thinking we're not very spiritual, we don't live the higher life, that's not helping anybody.
In that extent, no, it's not. But for most people who either are very strongly, they might, for instance, look at the idea of karma and say, and I understand the karma, but I don't understand the reincarnation part of it. That how can you have a cause without an effect? So there's just so many causes in any one lifetime. It's like this glass. You can take a big 2-gallon pitcher and start to fill this glass, but this glass ain't going to take no 2 gallons. There's just so much in any one lifetime that one can experience of causes that have been set up so that in one lifetime to get the effects. And there have been many people down through history who have lived a life a certain way, and then all of a sudden some big catastrophe happens and it changes their whole lifetime from then on. Historically, we're trying to think of the one with the canal.
Delessa,
that one. This man fell from the heights of public fame, shall we say, due to this problem. And it was a complete change. And there have been many people down through history who know and have felt they have been somewhere before, they've been in this situation, they know it. And yet in this lifetime, they can give you no connection where this came from. Way in the back.
What was just said, we think, was that the idea being we don't feel spiritual. It doesn't matter. We are spiritual at all times, in all conditions, in all situations. Perhaps what was being expressed was, how do I connect to that? How do I get the understanding that that's eternal? No matter what we believe about it, it is. And our job is to find a way to prove that for ourselves. Are we the same I that went to sleep last night, alive on another plane, and woke this morning? What did we carry back? What did we understand? But we are always spirit. It's the recognition of it that we're working on.
Too long we have worked, too many lifetimes we have worked on the form, on the material side of nature, rather than the spiritual. But yet, who knows, in some past life, any one of us could have been so close to being able to express it, but because we still had effects to live through and balance and harmonize on, it has to wait. You can just put so much into one lifetime. Yes?
This is a really hot topic for me, and it gets me really upset inside because I want so much to believe in karma and reincarnation in the way that you guys are describing, but I can't. I mean, it seems to me that it is the absolute ultimate way to perpetuate the ego, to perpetuate me, to say that this false, impermanent thing that I think is my body and my personality will go on and on and on and on and on. My interpretation, the only thing that makes sense to me, perhaps something that the Buddha was saying, is that we reincarnate, like for example, every time when we wake up in the morning. We wake up as pure, undifferentiated consciousness. And anytime we identify 100% with something, we reincarnate into that. And you can take it even a step further. You reincarnate into a thought that you feel definitively. Again, that little voice inside me is saying, this is not true. And I'm just being honest with myself. This doesn't make sense to me.
We think it's for each one to come to this on their own. Don't take it as being force-fed something. It's something that if you're really seriously keen on wanting to know, you're going to have to find some way of putting all your previous beliefs and thoughts on the table, shall we say. Push them aside for a while. And then try to approach it from another angle. But the thing of it is, we're talking about something that's permanent, not ever changing, which we can honestly say of our lives, look at all the changes we've been through. Look at all the things that we believed were true at one point and have dropped it now. As we gain in knowledge of ourselves and everyone, because basically there is no yes or no to this. This is something that has to come within and we have to work on to understand. If we don't see it, then maybe it's not the time to see it.
Or it could be dogma.
We don't think of it as dogma only because of where it has come from and from whom it has come from. It's beyond, shall we say, your history books, yes.
But actually, the contribution that was just made, he was right. He said, well, if reincarnation is just a way for me to perpetuate my own ego and hope that I live forever, you know, the lower stuff, well, it's not. That's not what Theosophy says.
Right.
That's what that, so right. In that sense, he's right. Come the end of a lifetime, all the stuff, I mean, you, not personally, but the human being, he's gone. Poof. It's done. And the immortal, spiritual, divine soul returns, yes, picks up tendencies, skandhas, and all sorts of stuff that has to be reset and has to be reestablished and has to be put back on its road to evolution. So whatever we do in this lifetime and screw up, when the soul comes back in the next lifetime, we have to fix it. But that doesn't mean that I personally am going to come back. I mean, when it's done, it's done.
True. Way in the
except
back.
Just to, oh, wait. Except to the extent that the human being in a given lifetime is able to assimilate his aspirations and experiences into his immortal soul, which is based on how he lives his life. To the extent that a human being does assimilate part of himself into his immortal soul, then he becomes immortal.
Mm. Yes, way in the back.
Maybe there's one term we haven't really looked at yet is the individuality versus the personality. And by we think that by knowing the difference between the two can kind of solve some of the confusion. And the individuality is the I. That is the spiritual aspect of us that will come back life after life to learn its lessons from previous lives. And then the personality, and it's one way to kind of figure out which is that the person, the form, is the personality, is the brain. It's the person, and that is the one that is going to die off, and the individuality will pick up the essences from that lifetime in the after-death states, and then go on from lifetime to lifetime. But there's an individuality and a personality, and the personality is the temporary.
True. Way in the back.
So just a quick remark that the personality is not just the body and the brain. When we, as thinkers, we're a thinker. That's the spiritual being. When we incarnate, we have a duality of mind.
True.
One half tends towards the universal and the compassionate. The other half is to the personal. So the real personality is our own lower mind. And we are the only ones who can keep track of that.
So true. And hopefully it might not be back again. Way in the back.
Well, to prove anything to ourselves, we're always told to look to nature. Nature will show us the clues to the questions that we have. And nothing, from our perspective, nothing in nature dies. It's simply re-embodied. It's constantly in change. And it's constantly silently progressing forward from the mineral to the vegetable to the animal to the human kingdom. So that we don't see death, we just see what we think is death, but it's always a spring. Whenever there's a winter, there's a spring. And that simply reflects what's in man's nature. So reincarnation is simply a process that the entire universe goes through. Planets and stars and everything that exists has a beginning and an end, but it also has a re-beginning.
And then, and it is what makes up the whole purpose of evolution. Yes.
We're going through the period on our way here. We couldn't help but notice all the leaves that were blowing around on the lawns and the piles, and how the trees are starting to look bare. We might think of our personalities as those leaves that have worn off and are dead and gone. And the tree that remains is alive, that's going to come forth with new leaves in the spring, is the individuality that incarnates. Yet without those leaves, without those personalities to draw from the sun and the water, the tree could not grow from season to season. And it's that way too. These personalities of ours are temporary, but they're very important to our spiritual evolution.
Evolution and growth. Yes.
I have to admit, I'm kind of caught in the leaves in this personality one. I hear people around. It suggests to me that there are people who are, and this is no humility, believe me, or farther along or in a different place, because if I were to let myself become really immersed in this, I would feel that I'm looking away from some personal, maybe if you want to say psychological, emotional things in my own life, and I wouldn't be giving them the time that I need to, right here. If I were to let myself, it may be that I'm not able to at this point. I don't know, but I would just have this feeling, and I think there are people here in other lodges who maybe been able to come to a resolution of some of the, say, emotional things in their lives, which is the personality.
True.
And they've gone beyond. Now, is this maybe a justifiable point for me to take, that I'm still fixated on those leaves?
It's all very possible. No, you know, we're not all in the same place. We're not all learning the same lessons. There are so many things that have to be balanced out that it can differ from individual to individual. But the fact of the matter is, somewhere, somehow, some way, this problem, quote, that you're going to, will be resolved. Because if it doesn't get learned this time, there'll be many more lifetimes that it'll possibly get learned. And it's not always an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It takes a lot of information to be gained so that one can actually turn something over. But if we look at something that is bothering us that much, we sort of wonder, is it something I really haven't taken the time to look at and try to understand? Or is it something I've just sort of pushed away, but I know it's there? Well, there'll have to come a time where you're going to have the strength and the energy to look at it, because you've put that effort through previously to try, that it will come out and balance itself. But again, that whole idea of detachment that comes from the East, the idea to be able to detach ourselves from some situation so that we can slowly move back and look at the whole thing. Because if we're right up in it, we can't see the whole thing. Way in the back.
There's a wonderful movie called A Thousand Words, and it's a very busy, materialistic moneymaker who comes to a guru for a fix, an answer. And what happens is a tree pops up in his yard, and every word he speaks, a leaf drops. And he starts to understand, when the last leaf drops, he'll be dead. So he begins to learn detachment by listening, watching, carefully choosing his words, and he finally releases an old anger he was holding, an old pain, and forgives. And that was the last leaf. And as soon as he forgave, the tree became full with leaves again. And it's a marvelous expression of everything that was just, it's called A Thousand Words.
Yes, yes.
Well, my point is this, what
would serve as valid proof that once the leaf falls, decays, and goes away in wintertime, that our bodies will come back again as another leaf the next season. So we, as those leaves, I mean, let's take the corollary of the question that was asked. What would be sufficient proof to say that this does exist? I mean,
our personalities, we're talking, we're the tree, we're not the leaves. Those are the personalities.
Your soul is the tree, your spirit is the tree.
That's what we're saying.
You're the leaf on that tree.
No. You might think you're the leaf on that tree. I don't think I'm the... I understand
so
that.
And
our time is really up. But it's something to think about. You decide, are you the leaf or are you the tree? We think that was a very good example. And hopefully we'll see you for the next one, which will take us right into evolution. Class is dismissed.
Oh, I'm an oath. Oh, you know, rather than an oath.